This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 257, was recorded on February 4th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Have you noticed a pattern where the vast majority of our smartest and most experienced macro veteran guests, such as Russell Napier last week, have all come around to a view that anticipates a return to secular inflation? Well, Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco is one of the smartest guys I know in the world of macro, and now he's joining the secular inflation camp as well. Jim returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the coming inflation and how to trade it, then we'll touch on the COVID pandemic, and finally we'll discuss the lunacy, which is Wall Street bets. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck will be titled Squeeze Insanity Part 2, The Aftermath. We'll discuss everything from GameStop to gold to crude oil to junk bond yield spreads.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's just start off with that S&P 500. A week ago, we were in sell mode right along that 50-day moving average, looking like maybe a correction may have been underway. And here we are right near the 52-week high again. What's your take on all of this?
Looks to me like by the time our listeners hear this, we'll probably have set another all-time high. We're just teetering right on the edge of it as we're recording on Thursday afternoon. And, you know, as much as all of the signs are here, extended leverage valuations, I mean, there's so many good arguments to say, okay, this has to be the top. I think it's a crack-up boom. I think that we've never had a time where central banks around the world are gearing up to do even more accommodation and creating more liquidity out of thin air. So I think it probably continues. It's really all about stimulus expectations. Don't let anybody tell you it's about a healthy booming economy. Healthy booming economy is punctuated by 5 to 10%. That's percent, not basis point, treasury yields. We've got 5 to 10 basis point treasury yields. So it's not about a healthy economy, but I think the bull market probably continues just based on stimulus.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because for over a month, we've been more or less pinned in this 90 to 91 range on the dollar index. And finally, the dollar index has been broken out. We're at 91.5 at the time of recording. Is this U.S. dollar breakout for real in your mind?
Well, you're the technician in the house, Patrick, but the way I see it, you know, the chart visually looks good. It looks like, wow, this thing's really got legs. But really, as I see it, the big test is a closing print over 92, because that was the previous support level. So is support going to turn into resistance? That would be the logical place for this to top out and turn around, if it's going to top out and turn around. So I'm waiting to see what happens when we get to 92. Seems pretty darn clear that we're going to get a test of 92. We're almost there today. So I think it's coming. I want to see what happens and whether we can get through that 92 level before I decide what's coming next. Till then, jury's out.
All right. Well, let's touch on crude oil then, because it really looked like crude oil was in this trade range last week, doing nothing around that 52, 54 range. And well, in the last 3-4 days, we've had a huge breakout, at least from the perspective of where we were. And we're heading, you know, north of 56 here on the front month contract. What's your take on this breakout?
Patrick, it seems like the theme we keep seeing, certainly since the beginning of November, has been every time we think, okay, surely the market's got to have at least a technical pullback, we only get a quick pause for breath before it moves higher. And every time we get into a technical consolidation, what I said last week is, okay, market's consolidating sideways, probably be at least a few more weeks of this. Well, no, it just didn't last. It's up, up, and away. The Z1, Z2 spread, which is my favorite way of trading this, broke 3 spot 20 today. That's plus 3 spot 20. And of course, our entry to that trade was minus 3 spot 20. That's 320 of contango. Tango back in June or so of 2020. So that's it's almost $6.50 on a calendar spread trade. That's a pretty big move, and I still think it has farther to go. Inventory this week, crude oil drawing down a million barrels, not as big as last week, but still helped to get things going. Gasoline was the build on the board at 4.5 million barrels. Distillates about flat. U.S. production, 10.9 million barrels, unchanged from last week.
All right, let's talk gold, because this is where it seems like we're getting a pretty big move. I mean, after a short squeeze story in silver last week, it really was, the question was, are we going to get a breakout in gold? And we're getting quite the opposite. It's gold's breaking down to a fresh month low, heading toward those November, December lows down around in the 1750 range. What's your take here on gold?
Patrick, I want to come back to gold when we get to the postgame segment so we can look at the chart, because I see breaking down below the 200-day moving average and now breaking down not just a little bit below it, but pretty decisively moving down from it as a pretty significant technical indication. And so the question is, what do you target in terms of downside? Now, big picture, I think this is a gift. I suspect that the catalyst for this is that Treasury yields are starting to back up. People are saying, okay, real yields increasing, that's gold's enemy. It's got to be bad for gold. That's probably what's going on here. As we're going to hear from Jim Bianco, Jim expects, Russell Napier expects, all the smart people seem to be expecting a return to inflation. And I don't think that those increasing real yields are going to last very long. So I think that the story for gold couldn't be more bullish long term. Looks like we're going to get a gift here of an opportunity to buy it lower. I want to know how much lower. So let's come back to this in the postgame segment.
All right, sounds like a plan, but let's just wrap up with talking about that 10-year Treasury yield, which held above 1% during the whole pullback throughout January. We've turned right back up and are heading right to the high of the year near one spot 20, where we're the top end of that range. We're trading around 114 right now. Do you think that this is the big breakout in the 10-year yield coming?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the big breakout. Maybe this is the big bounce event, which, you know, it certainly makes sense. We've had a pretty ridiculous amount of just collapse in Treasury yields over the last couple of years. Maybe the bounce is finally upon us, but I think it's a bounce. I don't think that you can go back to what I would call historically normal Treasury yields, a 10-year yield between 5 and 10%. I think as soon as you get past about 3.5%, it starts to really, really cripple the economy, and I'm not sure you can even get that far. So I don't know how far you can go, but I don't think this is anything like time to, you know, back the leverage truck up and short treasuries because we're going back to 8% yields in the next few years. I don't think that that's remotely possible because it would bankrupt the federal government. So I think they're going to allow inflation to run, but they're still going to keep yields suppressed, and potentially that could lead to runaway inflation. I want to ask that question specifically of Jim Bianco in this feature interview.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Jim Bianco. So, Eric, why did we invite Jim back onto the show this week?
Patrick, Jim Bianco is one of the smartest guys that I know, period. He was one of very, very few people who predicted the pandemic crisis even before I did. And he's also got a very strong fixed income background. So I really wanted to get his perspective. Now, we are going to talk about the Wall Street Bets nonsense. Back when we recorded this interview on Tuesday morning, everybody was still talking as if the big silver squeeze was the big story and we were, you know, going much higher in silver. It looks like even the Wall Street Bets crowd has figured out that was a stupid idea on their own. So if it seems like we're uninformed, just keep in mind that Jim and I, when we were recording this interview, it so far had only been straight up on silver prices. Looks like that has finally come to its senses. Anyway, I think you're going to find it's a terrific interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Jim Bianco is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with social media executive Kirsten Stewart is available now at smartermarketspod.com. My guest on Smarter Markets this coming Saturday morning will be Dr. Ben Hunt, author of the Epsilon Theory newsletter, and we're really going to get into what happened with social media and Twitter and Wall Street Bets and all the rest of it in this Saturday's episode. But you won't get Smarter Markets episodes on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this exciting free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco. Jim is known for his graphs and charts. There is a chart deck to accompany this week's interview. We won't be going over the slides page by page, but you're going to want to download this chart deck because there are charts and graphs that will supplement a number of different conversation topics that we're going to touch on today. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button above Jim's picture that says looking for the downloads. Jim, it's great to get you back on the program. You know, I had Russell Napier on the show last week, and something I'm noticing, Russell was one of the devout deflationists for the last several years. And I'm seeing really smart people who were convinced it was deflation coming around to an inflationary view. I'm very curious what your reaction is and what your outlook is in terms of inflation versus deflation, particularly in light of the change of the presidential administration and all of the stimulus that's being contemplated.
Well, I would probably put myself somewhat into Russell's camp. I wasn't a deflationist until this summer, but I was always arguing, I was a bond bull, and I was saying that inflation is not a problem. But then this summer, I jokingly say I became an inflationista this summer. And I'm looking for higher levels of inflation as we move forward from here. Now, why? I think the biggest thing is the amount of government stimulus. We're mailing people checks. We mailed them a $1,200 check in the spring. We're just finishing up mailing them a $600 check. We're going to mail them a $1,400 check. We're giving people extra money for unemployment. They were getting $600 a month until August. They're now getting $300. And if the new stimulus package that's being negotiated stands as is being presented, that $300 will last all the way through to September 30th, plus bailouts for the states as well and the cities and a whole bunch of other stuff. And then they'll start on an infrastructure spending program right after that. A lot of people ask me, well, how can you have inflation if there's no wage inflation? And I said, right at large. This is about a larger measure called personal income, which the biggest thing on personal income is wages. But in 2020, a record 20% of all of the income that the American public got came from the government mailing it to them. So 1/5 of all the money came from the government. And there's more checks going out now, and they're debating even more checks. Too much money, you know, is where I think it is. And that will eventually chase into too many goods. Now, short term, that money is being saved. There is a fear about the economy. Right now, it's not open. A lot of people unemployed. They're not in the mood to go out and purchase a car, remodel their kitchen, because they don't know what their job situation is going to be. So, and I know we'll talk about this later. So they've been saving it, and that's been finding its way into brokerage accounts and all of the Wall Street Bet stuff and everything else has been fostered by that as well, too. But I do think, though, that there is a consequence to all this money printing. And the more you do it, the more it will stimulate the economy. And I also think that it's not going to stop. My leftist economist friends say, this is not enough to create inflation. And my response to them, other than debating whether it's enough, is who said they're done? They're going to keep going until we go too far. If all we've done is send people money, and the argument is the poor got something, maybe it wasn't as efficient as we liked. The unemployed got a bridge, they got some extra money, and a lot of it went into brokerage accounts that helped push the stock market to new all-time highs. Isn't the answer there, everybody won? So if everybody won, send them more money. And then if they win again, which we just did, we sent them more money and the stock market's back at all-time highs, send them more money again and again until we go too far. And I think too far is inflation.
Now, Jim, the study of what causes inflation and what controls inflation, unfortunately, in the study of economics, feels to me oftentimes more like religion than science. But at least one of the versions of that religion says, okay, the way this inflation stuff works is, you know, they provide accommodation, they do things to stimulate the economy. Eventually, it goes too far, you get to inflation, and the remedy is the government simply increases interest rates, and that arrests the inflation, and it's all cured. The thing is, Jim, what it seems to me that we're headed toward is what I'll call an inflation trap, where you get to that point where it's time for the Fed to raise short-term interest rates aggressively in order to contain the inflation, stop it from running away, but they can't, because doing so would bankrupt the U.S. government, because we've got so much more debt on the books than we did 20 or 30 years ago. Would you agree that this idea of what has to eventually contain inflation? Does this idea of increasing interest rates really even come into play? Because that's not necessarily science, that's more religion. And if so, would you agree that there's a trap set up that might be on the horizon?
Yeah, let's look back at the last two cycles, just as a quick measure, what's been happening with the Fed. And I'm talking about December of 2018. The Fed had made noise all through the fourth quarter of 2018. We're going to reduce the size of the balance sheet. And then on December 19th, Jay Powell holds a press conference and he says, we're going to reduce the balance sheet by $60 billion a month. It will be on automatic pilot and it'll be about as interesting as watching paint dry. The stock market fell 3% in the 1 hour of his press conference and kept getting crushed all the way through Christmas Eve. It was down 19.8%, nearly a 20% correction from its September 2018 high to Christmas Eve. January 4th, Powell was speaking at the American Economic Association annual meeting in Atlanta, and he did what is famously known as the Powell pivot, where he said, no, the Fed's going to be patient and flexible. So the Fed spent months and months and months, articulated a plan to reduce the balance sheet. Market didn't like it. 10 days later, forget it. We're now patient and flexible. Let's go to a year ago. The late January meeting, the Fed held the funds rate steady at 2.5%. Everything's fine. We see no reason to be doing anything with the funds rate for as far as we can see. Literally hours after that meeting, the market started to wobble because it started to become aware of the coronavirus coming out of China. Within 15 days of that meeting, the Fed cut the funds rate 50 basis points. And within a month of that meeting, the Fed had put rates at zero. So my point is, the Fed will lay out these careful plans, and they'll pat themselves on the back, and then the market will reject it, and within 2 weeks, they'll change everything. So yes, what will happen is inflation will creep up, and the Charlie Evanses of the world, who last month said, oh, we at the Fed could see 2.5% inflation without moving rates, and Rich Clarida, the vice chairman, put out a very wonky academic paper talking about why the Fed could see the average inflation rate run over 2%, and they wouldn't adjust policy. And I've always answered the question, it's not their call. It's the market's call. If inflation starts moving up and the market at some point says, enough, I don't like it, and bonds sell off and rates go up, they'll be within 2 weeks of changing policy, because they'll have the market will force it upon them that they have to start to change policy then at that point. So I think that you're right that they're not going to want to do it. They're going to be forced to do it at some point. And the last thought for you, Eric, one of the Fed's favorite measures of inflation is the core personal consumption expenditure, or core PCE. If that number hits 2.6%, that would be a 28-year high. Now, when I say inflation, especially if certain people of an age, oh, they'll start thinking 10%, 7%, something like that, 5%. Others will think 1,000,000% because they're thinking of Zimbabwe or something like that. And when I say, how about 2.6 on core? They look at me, that's not inflation. I say, well, it's a 28-year high and interest rates are 1.1. That would put you with a deeply negative real rate. That's a good place to start. So when I talk about inflation, I'm not talking about some big, gigantic number. Maybe that's 2, 3, 4 years down the road, but it wouldn't take much now. And if you got to 2.6, Charlie Evans will say, no big deal. We told you that we would hold the line here. But like 2018 and 2020, if the bond market rejects it, the Fed will be forced to move in kind.
What's the play for investors? If you see this inflation on the horizon, is it long commodities? Is it something else? What do you do to trade this?
Well, yes. The answer is, I think that the traditional inflation plays have been working. Short bonds, they're at 1.11, 10-year yield as we record. Long commodities, long industrial stocks, and basic material stocks relative to the entire market, that is, as well, too, should continue to do better. But I also want to put a little nuance on it. What determines interest rates from an economic standpoint? Why are some countries' interest rates at 10%? Others are negative. Ours are at 1%. And the answer is expected nominal GDP, expected nominal growth. Now, nominal growth is real growth and inflation. Now, for the last 25 years or so, whenever interest rates went up, it was real growth expanded. And that was good. And everybody's like, okay, that's more profits, more jobs, better standards of living. Interest rates are going up. That's fine. That's why Wall Street thinks of rising rates as a sign of prosperity. But if instead nominal growth is being driven like it was in the 70s up and the 80s down by inflation, that's not so good as well, too. From 1966 to 1982, the stock market lost 2/3 of its after-inflation value. Stocks were not a good inflation hedge. They were among some of the worst inflation hedges. It wasn't until the mid-1990s that they recovered all of that lost inflation value. So in that environment, we're talking a lot about the phrase on Wall Street is reflation. Well, the commodities work in that, the basic materials, the industrials work in that, higher interest rates work in that. But if it morphs over to inflation, which I think it will, you know, going from R to I, those same plays still work. And that's what the trick is when people say, what's the inflation play? And I say what it is, commodities, industrials, basic materials, cyclicals, if you want to throw those in there as well too, higher rates. They look at me and say, well, isn't that the same as the economy booming? And don't we want the economy to boom? And it's like, that's the trouble. That's the tough part about it is they start off the same way, but it can morph into inflation. Now, just because we haven't seen it since the early 1990s, everybody's forgotten about it, but it could come back as inflation, and then the bond market could really have a problem.
Jim, when I hear somebody say that, I always tell them that a booming economy is defined by treasury yields in the 5 to 10% range. We have treasury yields in the 5 to 10 basis points range. Is it as simple as I make it? It seems to me like you just can easily debunk any strong and vibrant economy argument just by treasury yields alone. Am I missing anything there?
Yo, I think you're right. And I think the problem with treasury yields is, you know, in the stock market, there's an argument about a moral hazard because the Fed's got your back. There's a perception that there's no risk. So go ahead and speculate to the moon in the stock market. Okay, I get that. And that's true. But it's worse in the bond market. The Federal Reserve owns 30% of all treasury notes and bonds right now. They're buying them at a clip of $120 billion a month right now. So you've got a lot of people, they're in the bond market and they're, you know, you go, why are you owning yields at 1.1%? And you've heard people say that the treasury market has no value, it's overvalued. It's been that way for about 12 years now because you've got this big buyer with a printing press that's holding these, suppressing these yields right now. And they haven't been tested with this idea of inflation because it hasn't been existed in the last 12 years or so. But if they do get tested with this inflation argument, then I do think they're going to get tested. I've used this metaphor many times, that the Fed is like a post in the ground and the market is a horse tethered to the post. And so the horse stands there right where the Fed wants it because it sets where it wants to put the post. But if that horse ever gets spooked and inflation would spook it, it's an 1,100-pound animal. It can rip that post right out of the ground and go wherever it wants. And we've seen that with the BOJ and with the ECB, that at times when their bond markets get spooked, they'll just flatten their central bank as well. So if our central bank, if our bond market gets spooked by inflation, yeah, the Fed will be there and they've been buying the market and yields have been low, but the bond market will just, you know, rip the post right out of the ground and go where it wants.
Jim, I want to move on to the pandemic situation. I can count on one hand the number of people in finance who were ahead of me in seeing this pandemic coming and predicting what it would mean for markets. You are the absolute top of the list. And in fact, it was your charts and graphs that really persuaded me that a pandemic was imminent back in January of last year. So as the man who was probably the first I can think of to have called this, any new insights or what are you thinking in terms of the strains and the various things that are going on in the COVID crisis?
Well, I think there's two things. First of all, there are the potentials of new strains, and I don't know enough about the new strains to say other than that they're an undefinable risk. But what I am looking at is the pace of vaccinations. And, you know, the CDC and WHO have some really good data. Bloomberg has actually put this together. If you Google Bloomberg Vaccine Tracker, they've got a very good page that they keep up to date in real time. And I want to focus on the country of Israel. And the reason I want to focus on Israel is leading the world right now when it comes to vaccinations. 55% of their population has gotten at least one of the two doses. 20% of their population has gotten the second dose or the full vaccine. Now that compares, if you want to compare that to another country that's running way ahead on the scale, is the United States. The United States is actually doing a very good job, but we've only got 1.9% of our population with two doses versus 20 in Israel. And we've only got 8% with one dose versus 55 in Israel. If you look at the numbers in the infection counts in Israel, they've peaked about a week ago at around 7,500 on a rolling 7-day basis, and they're down, you know, about 1,000 to about 6,500 or so right now. And I look at that and I say, okay, they needed half their population to get one dose and nearly a quarter of their population to get two doses just to put a peak in. And then I think about the U.S. and I'm like, okay, so that's 150 million people with one dose. And that's roughly 60, 65 million people with a second dose before we could really start to see a bend in the curve. And Biden is pushing 100 million shots in 100 days. This is going to take the bulk of 2022 at the current pace we're going with these vaccines in order to maybe, you know, make some real headway. And that's just the U.S. Remember that all it takes one person from one country to come into your country with a new strain and infect it everywhere. So we really need to get these vaccines worldwide. It could be well into 2022 before we've vaccinated enough of the world and enough of the United States to say it's worked. We've now effectively gotten herd immunity. And again, this assumes no mutation that comes along that makes the vaccine less effective.
Jim, one of the things that I hear quite a bit is concern that younger people in the United States have concluded that there are risks inherent to the vaccine. There's no risk of any consequence to them of actually dying from this disease. Therefore, they don't want to take it. And of course, the counterargument is that society needs them to take it in order to achieve herd immunity. They're not buying it. They're saying, hey, I'm not going to risk my own health in order to contribute supposedly to herd immunity, which is an unproven concept. Do you think that's going on? And is there a way to measure it? I mean, it logically, it makes sense, but I don't know if that's true. Is there a way to tell from the data?
Well, there is and there isn't. A couple of things. So according to the surveys, the polling that's been done, somewhere between 50 to 70% of the public is willing to take the vaccine, or restated, 30 to 50% of the public is not interested in the vaccine right now. I've argued, you know, you could probably get into April or May or maybe even June before you even get to those people. So if you vaccinate, you know, 40% of the public or so, 40% get a first jab, maybe they'll come around a little bit on that data, on their thinking about it, because right now they're all afraid of it. And they're like, well, wait a minute, 100 million Americans have gotten vaccinated and nothing terrible's happened. And maybe they'll soften up a little bit at that point. As far as young people thinking that they're bulletproof, I'll just give you one anecdote, and this is from this weekend. One of the guys who works for me is, we're in Chicago, and he's very smart. He's spending the winter in Laguna Beach, California. I'm here shoveling 15 inches of snow, so you know who the smart guy is right now in this equation. And he told me that Friday in California, they lifted the lockdown bans. And he said Laguna Beach went from a ghost town to Mardi Gras in less than 24 hours. Every bar was packed. They were flowing out into the streets. No one was wearing masks. They were drunk. They were partying all over the place. And he concluded by saying to me, we're going to have to go back in the lockdown in about a month because these cases are going to spike right back up all over again. So yeah, this is a real problem because it seems like we're binary, you know, both in Europe and the United States. It's either we're in lockdown and we scream that the government is imposing an undue burden on us, or we go from 0 to 60 miles an hour instantly and everybody's Mardi Gras at that point. And it's not like we can have some kind of middle ground right now. So I fear that, you know, this is why we have these certain waves. We do what's necessary to slow the transmission. Then we ease up and the transmission picks up. Then we slow it. Then we ease up and the transmission picks up. Wash, rinse, and repeat. So we're not there yet. And I think that people that are thinking that we're going to be there, say the financial markets, that we're going to be there shortly and this is going to be behind us soon, they might become a little bit disappointed as we move forward.
I completely agree with you on that. This crisis, unfortunately, is getting worse, not better. And yes, there is a light at the end of the tunnel thanks to the vaccines, but that's a distant end of the tunnel. Jim, let's move on to Wall Street Bets and what's been going on in the revenge of retail, if you will. I know that you wrote an interesting piece on Bloomberg. You were also interviewed recently on Fox. I had a chance to read and watch both of those. Last week, the story was GameStop. This week, the story seems to be silver. What's going on here? Who's behind it? What should we expect?
Okay, so I think that there's been a paradigm shift on Wall Street. That paradigm shift has started, as we all know, many years in the making with the availability of information on everybody's fingertips and on their phones. There's very little data or analysis that sophisticated institutional investors have that a retail investor cannot get access to, and most of it is free. But the institutional investor has a cost advantage. Well, in 2019, that cost advantage went away because we went to zero commissions. Well, the institutional investor has a size advantage. Well, early last year, the size advantage went away with fractional share purchases. You like Amazon and it's a $3,300 stock and you don't have $3,300? Don't worry about it. You could buy a tenth of a share for $330, no commission. But we don't have any money to really play on this. Don't worry, the government mailed you a lot of money. So you can open up your account with as little as a few hundred dollars as well. Well, I'm sitting at home and I don't really know what to do. Don't worry about it. We've got several social media websites. Obviously, the big one is Reddit and Wall Street Bets. There's StockTwits. There's Seeking Alpha. There's FinTwit on Twitter. There's a lot of others. If you follow along on those communities, you can learn a lot more about the market, or you could just be one of the large momentum traders in those communities. So I think that we've now, in total, have created this big player that has organized through social media. It has got millions of players. There's more than 7.5 million people now signed up on Wall Street Bets. And that doesn't even include the ones on FinTwit and everything else. It gets to be very, very large numbers. And even though they're all small, they could move in different directions. They're also playing in the options market, and that's the so-called gamma squeeze right now. The option market is being dominated by small traders. In fact, I even tweeted out the day we're recording that the option market has now become the domain of the small trader. It used to be one of the most sophisticated institutional tools, but now the small trader is working in that market. And we've seen them win along the way repeatedly. Back in May, Warren Buffett sold his airlines, and he said, I wish the airlines well, but I don't see a prospect for them. And a bunch of people led by Dave Portnoy, Davy Day Trader, said that Warren Buffett's, you know, old and past his prime, and he's wrong on the airlines. And they banded together and they doubled the price of the airlines in a month. And the price today is even higher. So for now, the retail investor won by beating Superman, Warren Buffett. Then the retail investor said, you know, stuck at home, I think that these work from home stocks and these emerging technology stocks, these are the new trends. But these active managers that work in big office buildings in Boston, they think they're overvalued. They don't want to touch them. They're not part of the S&P 500. So they started buying all of these racy, non-profitable tech companies, and they've gone up hundreds of percent since they've bought them. They won again. The highlighted by the big one was Tesla. They ran Tesla up from $100 in March to over $700, and it got it to be the fifth largest stock, and it's now part of the S&P 500. They won again there. And then you get to what's happened now. Now, a different type of crowd is on Wall Street Bets. That's the retail trader, not maybe the retail investor, which I was describing before. They were looking at GameStop because it had the single largest short interest on the New York Stock Exchange, well over 100% of the float, which should be illegal in most terms. You can't short more than exists as well. And they pointed out no less than Melvin Capital being in the middle of that trade. And they were talking about, we need a catalyst in order to basically squeeze the shorts. This goes back to October that this was out there on this. And that catalyst came in mid-January. There was a big surge of put buying. And then Citron Research put out its short recommendation on GameStop. And a bunch of people on Wall Street Bet said, this is it. They just rang the bell. It's time to squeeze these shorts. And we know what's happened in the last 10 to 14 days or so with an extraordinary short squeeze. And now we're on the backside of this trade as well, too. At its basis, what they're doing in a lot of these cases is Wall Street operates under its own set of rules. You know, at a minimum, what these shorts were doing in GameStop and a lot of these other meme stocks, as they call them, was they were doing imprudent risk management at a minimum. They should have never had shorts that big, maybe even illegal because it should never get that over 100% of the float. But the SEC is not doing anything about it. The SEC was invented in 1933 because of abusive short practices in the 29 crash. And they're 90 years later and they still can't get their act together in trying to rein in abusive short practices as well too. They all looked around and maybe there was a little bit of arrogance. If you could be like a fly in the wall 3 weeks ago and said, hey guys, isn't 100% short kind of risky? I think the answer would have been, yeah, well, who's going to do anything about it? You think Goldman Sachs is going to stick it to us? You think JP Morgan's going to stick it to us? You think another big hedge fund's going to stick it to us? Yeah, it's not risky if no one is big enough or interested enough to stick it to us. Well, we found a group that's big enough and interested enough to basically play their own rules against them. And that was this short crowd. And how do we know that they were playing together? Because what is the first thing they did when Melvin Capital ran into trouble? Bailed them out. They got big bailouts from Citadel and Point72. Let me contrast that to 20 years earlier, 23 years earlier to be exact, Long-Term Capital. When Long-Term Capital was in a big trade that had imprudent risk management, what did the other hedge funds do? They shot and killed them and basically almost blew up the whole market at the same time. But today, when we see somebody doing something imprudent like Long-Term Capital, we play along and we protect them. And so that's where I think that the Wall Street Bets crowd is the big game changer right now, is that they are now looking at Wall Street's way of doing business and saying, I could take advantage of that. And they have. Repeatedly, they took advantage of the small stocks because they weren't in the indexes, and the Graham and Dodd value investors at active managers didn't want to touch them. And now they took advantage of a big giant short squeeze as well, too.
Jim, it's interesting because I agree with many parts of what you say, but there are some aspects of this where I think we are in disagreement. So I'd love to run my ideas past you and have you critique them, because the place where I don't think this all adds up is the narrative you're hearing is, okay, what happened here is a bunch of Wall Street outsiders, retail guys, normal, ordinary, hardworking men and women who have nothing to do with this corrupt industry of Wall Street, figured out how to beat those stinking hedge fund guys at their own game. Hallelujah. Well, first of all, if that's actually true, I say double hallelujah, because I think the Wall Street hedge fund crowd deserves exactly what they got. But I don't think that's what happened. I think that Wall Street insiders who understood the opportunity to put this squeeze on GameStop borrowed the playbook of terrorists. And what we've learned from the last 20 years with terrorism in the Middle East is if you get young men, particularly young men who have been through very traumatic childhoods, and you fill their heads full of enough passion for their cause that they're willing to trade their own life for the cause, you get a small army, but an incredibly powerful army, because they're willing to go and be suicide bombers and do things that are not in their own best interest for the cause. And what I see going on here is somebody who was very smart and understood exactly what it takes to put a short squeeze on and knew to wait for the catalyst and all the things that you said. I find it very hard to believe that a Davy Day Trader type of character was smart enough to figure all of that out. Certainly not Dave Portnoy. Somebody was smart enough to figure all of that out. I'm guessing that they were Wall Street insiders, other hedge funds. And I think what they did is they played the Wall Street bets crowd and said, look, you know, they were very quiet, probably starting in October, putting their long positions and their option, you know, their calls and everything on GameStop. And then they very dramatically pulled the trigger and they got an army of young people who don't really understand how these markets work and what they're doing to be the sacrificial wolves. Because it's not just the guy who bought at $22 when it first started moving up. It's when you got to $502 before it went to $504 or whatever the top was, that some retail guy is still buying there. So yes, there's a handful of retail people that made an absolute killing, and you know, you're hearing about them on the internet, normal, ordinary mom and pops who followed the advice that they saw on Wall Street bets, you know, made 20 times what they invested or 50 times, whatever it was. I think there's a larger number of people who lost their shirts, because if you look at the volatility and what happened in GameStop, the guys that were buying at the top totally, completely got nailed on this. And I think they were sacrificed by somebody who knew exactly what they were doing. And that what they knew how to do is they said, we're Wall Street insiders. We know that most people, especially young people in this country, hate our guts. What can we do? We can tell them that we're on their side. We can do it on social media, on the internet, so it looks to them like we're them, even though we're not them. And we'll get them to believe that we're getting even. And the thing I find most interesting about this, Jim, is I've read several accounts from people who did lose their shirt and say they have no regrets because they're so proud of themselves for having participated in a movement to do the right thing, to stick it to the man, that they don't care that they lost their money. That's the reason I invoke the analogy of suicide bombers. These people have been deluded into believing that if they lose all of their money, it's for the cause. The cause here, I think, was a bunch of a large number of people on Wall Street bets were played by Wall Street insiders who knew exactly what they were doing. That's my take on what's really going on here. What am I missing? Why is it? I would love you to explain to me why it really is a case of people who are Wall Street outsiders beating Wall Street at its own game. I would celebrate and cheer for that. Unfortunately, I don't think it's what happened.
Well, first of all, you know, as a caveat, we don't know what's happened. There hasn't been a forensic analysis, and there won't be for some time. So we're going to do some suppositions here. And I think that you're right that the masters of the universe, to quote the book Bonfires of the Vanities about hedge funds, they jumped in. But what happened with them is that they're no longer the people setting the agenda. They're basically momentum traders like everybody else. And you're right, Dave Portnoy didn't figure this out. Dave Portnoy knows who to listen to, and he basically follows along with the rest of them as well, too. I think this started with retail investors on these boards, and I think it might have got exacerbated by some hedge funds jumping in after the squeeze started. S3 Partners does a good job of estimating, and have always has, of estimating short interest on a daily basis. And they estimated that on Friday morning or Thursday's close, the short interest in GameStop was something along the lines of 113% of the float. And that by Friday night, 24 hours later, so Friday, it had fallen to like 51%. So in other words, 57 million shares were short and it went down to 27 million shares short just on Friday. What also happened on Friday was the price hit $400. Now it hit its absolute peak on Wednesday, but then we had that shutting down of trading on Thursday. What it looks very clear to me about is that Friday, it looked like the $400 buyer was a short cover. And then all of those nosebleed level buyers was more a short cover than it wasn't a short cover as well too. And I think that in total, Melvin Capital lost 53% of its money. I guess we're going to call them Melvin Half Capital now. We know that Point72 took a big loss. We know that D1 Capital took a big loss. We know that Maple Lane took a big loss. We're waiting on all of these funds to basically tell their investors what their January returns were. They usually tell them on February 1st. A lot of them haven't said anything. That should be a sign of what happened to the hedge fund community. In total, I think the hedge fund community came out of this worse than the retail investor. Now, there's 7.5 million people out there. Did somebody lose their shirt? I bet they did. Davey Day Trader took a $700,000 loss, but that's not catastrophic for him. He'll live. He might even make it back by the end of the week, with given the extreme volatility that that guy trades with as well, too. He might lose it again before the end of the week. But in general, if you were to ask me, big picture, what happened here? I think it was a lot of retail investors. And a lot of these people, like 95% or 98% of them are trend followers. There's a group of influencers, just like all social media, that basically told them, guys, let's go. And they went. And when the stock started moving, a bunch of professionals on Wall Street said, we got to get in on this. And then, you know, so they were there too, but they weren't the initiator of this trade. It was.
But we don't know who the initiator of the trade was, to be fair, right?
Right. To be fair, there is, yes, because we're talking supposition. We don't know who the initiator of the trade is. We do know that some of the names of some of the more prominent people on Reddit have been coming out, and we're finding out that they are, you know, in some cases, the guy Roaring Kitty, who, you know, I can't believe in 20, you know, we're talking about Wall Street, we have to use the name Roaring Kitty, but that's what 2021 has brought us to. He was one of the big, big proponents of all of this on Wall Street. He's a wealth manager, a 34-year-old wealth manager with a CFA. So he's not, you know, he doesn't work for a big billion-dollar hedge fund, but he's not ignorant of the financial system because he's already got a CFA and he's been pushing these kind of trades as well too. So, and then if, again, if you go back and go, they bought the work from home stocks. Who bought Tesla? Who was ramping Tesla up 600%? You know, who embarrassed Buffett in the airlines? Who's been buying cryptos to get Bitcoin to, you know, get briefly over 40,000 as well too? I think this crowd is a big dominant crowd. And I want to emphasize my take on this is they're looking at kind of the way Wall Street does business. And they're saying, these guys, we could take advantage of this because they don't think there's anybody else out there that can, you know, can come in and play this. Now, with that said, I think this is the last short squeeze. No one is ever going to be caught short in a big way in a stock again. Pershing Square, Bill Ackman's hedge fund, last night put out a statement that they have no short positions as of the end of January. Why did he feel necessary to do that? And I think, you know, my friend Bill Fleckenstein was quoted last week as saying, and Mark Cahutas, the big short seller, they think this is going to destroy the short selling business right now. Short selling is a necessary thing, especially the way that the Jim Chanos of the world do it. They identify fraudulent companies. They put on a position. They explain why they're fraudulent companies and they profit. They take their risk and they profit on it. And they probably make the world a better place because they get rid of bad companies and bad actors. Of course, now we've abused that short selling a little bit too much. And that's what they took advantage of. But if we're going to wipe out all the shorts, I think we're worse off than we were, you know, then we'll be worse off without the shorts. We should have found a way to not let the system get abused in the first place so that we're going to go too far the other way. That Bill Ackman, who runs a long short fund, basically just announced he's a long only manager. He doesn't have a single short and he's afraid to put one on right now.
Let's move on to the next chapter in this story, Jim, because frankly, if I were to grade the job that whoever designed, initiated, and orchestrated the squeeze on GameStop, that's A++++ in terms of somebody understanding the market mechanics, how it works, how to engineer a short squeeze. They absolutely aced it. Now we move on to this week's sourced from Wall Street Bets squeeze on the silver market. You'd have to be about the stupidest gold bug idiot on the planet to believe that Wall Street Bets is going to squeeze silver to $1,000 an ounce, which is what the nonsense that's coming out of there says. Now, I cannot for an instant believe that it's coming from the same accounts on Wall Street Bets, but in the perception of a lot of people, it's like last week, Wall Street Bets totally killed it with this squeeze on this GameStop, whatever that is. I don't really understand the mechanics of how it works. But my God, they made a fortune. And now they say it's silver. This is a can't lose. Gotta just go. And my favorite part is in one of the things that I read that came off of Wall Street Bets. The way to squeeze silver, according to them, is to buy PSLV, which is a closed-end fund, which indicates whoever wrote this has absolutely no concept of what they're talking about. But people are perceiving this as, hey, Wall Street Bets last week totally nailed it. This is, I can't lose.
Yeah. PSLV is the Sprott Closed End Silver Fund, which trades at a gigantic premium as well too. And there's no doubt that there has been a perception out there that the next big play is silver. If you look at SLV, the iShares Silver Trust, it took in $589 million just yesterday. That was its second best day in history. Its first best day in history was the day before Friday, took in about $900 million. And its third best day in history was Thursday. So there's been a ton of money that's gone in there. Now, in fairness to the Wall Street Bets crowd, there's a giant debate out there on the Reddit board whether or not they're in agreement that they should be playing silver. A lot of the players that were successful in this, you know, the screen names that were successful in this GameStop short and have been successful before have been saying, no, we're not doing the silver thing. This is taking on a life beyond us and we're being accused of it. Others are saying, no, we've got to do this short on silver. So it's unclear whether or not there's a consensus that is formed on silver out there. But after what happened in GameStop, it almost doesn't matter is if everybody believes it, and now the outsiders of, in this case, the outsiders of Reddit, you know, are reading it in the Wall Street Journal, are reading it in Bloomberg News, you know, are reading it in the FT, they're all running into it as well too. So it's unclear whether they're not, they're doing this trade. And I agree with you. It is kind of a head scratcher why they decided that it would become silver would become the trade. I don't get the hook. I don't get what they think the advantage is. Their argument is that there's not enough cash bars in the world. There's not enough silver coins in the world. So that if we ramp up the paper silver markets, then the hedge, either they'll have to buy cash or the hedgers will have to buy cash that sold them some other put option or something like that to protect themselves. And that they'll eventually squeeze the cash market to the moon and force the paper PSLVs and SLVs up with them. That's sort of the argument they're making. I understand the argument, but I'm not sure it's right. You know the silver market probably better than me. Does that make sense to you?
I think what's going on here is somebody who believes in the nonsense that's been circulating in the silver market for decades is taking the old story of the supposed secret cabal of bullion bankers that are suppressing the price of silver. And what they're doing is people who don't understand how the market works. One gentleman in Florida in particular, whose name I won't mention, publishes a newsletter saying, look at the commercial, just outsized shorts on the commitment of traders reports. obviously, these people have this massive short. They're trying to force the market lower. Now, of course, you and I understand, Jim, the business that bullion bankers are in is not taking risk. So when they have a large vault full of physical silver longs, they balance that with paper shorts in the futures market. And that's the way they hedge market risk. So there is no, you know, conspiracy to suppress the price of silver. But people who don't understand how to interpret commitment of traders reports have been pushing this story for years. I think what happened is somebody who believed that nonsense is a member of Wall Street Bets and said, hey, our next play should be, you know, the most crazy opportunity I've ever heard of a bunch of corrupt bullion bankers being short that we could squeeze out is this stinking situation in the silver market. It was always bullshit for the last 20 years that these ideas have been circulating. They've never been true and they're not true now. But I think that after what happened with GameStop, which was a brilliantly engineered short squeeze, they're saying, we've got the power. The people can take on Wall Street. Let's do it. And so, I mean, I own silver, so I'm all for people irrationally bidding up the price of silver. That's just fine with me. But they're not going to squeeze any shorts out of the market. They're not going to take it to $1,000. The notion that they have that they're somehow going to consume the available supply of physical silver. What they think is supposedly going to happen is if they keep buying SLV, SLV physically owns bullion in a vault to back its holdings, which means they have to buy more bullion. They'll run out of physical silver, and they've got this nutcase idea that's been circulating for decades where supposedly the physical price is going to decouple from the paper price. And then what they do is when, very predictably, the price of retail coins and bars decouples from the wholesale price of physical silver, they misinterpret that, and they say, look, the paper price and the physical price are different now. There's a huge premium on physical. It's because the paper market is crumbling and it's about to collapse. That's nonsense. The paper price and the wholesale price of 1,000-ounce silver bars is still the same except for a small amount of basis between the front-month futures and the spot market. The real difference that's occurring is the difference between the cost of those 1,000-ounce wholesale bars and the retail products like coins and retail-sized bars, which have a huge premium on them because a whole bunch of people are falling for this nonsense. So I don't think it's going anywhere. I mean, they can certainly bid up the price of retail coins and bars. The retail precious metals dealers are going to love them. Maybe the retail precious metals dealers are behind this. Don't discount that possibility. But I do not think they're going to squeeze anybody out of the market or cause a run on physical silver deliveries that results in, you know, $1,000 an ounce price or whatever they think is going to happen. I think that's completely diluted.
So I agree with you. And I've always been dubious of this silver idea as well, too. But let me also, for the listeners, point out something else that seems to be evolving. And you want to talk about stick it to the man. Think about this. First of all, there is something that's very healthy that's going on Wall Street Bets. And it's two words. The first one is loss porn. Loss, P-O-R-N, porn. And what that is that no one is allowed to go out and brag about their winners unless you brag about your loser. And when you say loser, I mean, I want a screenshot of your trade ticket that you actually bought this thing and got killed on it. And they celebrate their losses as much as they celebrate their wins. That's why, as we speak today, Dave Portnoy tweets out, I took a $700,000 loss getting out of all my meme stocks. They're completely fine with telling you that this game is like baseball. If I fail 7 out of 10 times, that means I'm successful. 3 out of 10, I'm a 300 hitter. I get paid riches. That's healthy. I wish more of Wall Street would do that instead of trying to pretend that all the smart guys bat 99% on every trade that they do. They don't. And so that's good. And then the other phrase you'll hear from them a lot is the phrase YOLO, which if you're not familiar with it, it's you only live once, or their version of carpe diem. And the reason that they talk about YOLO options is what they're saying is, hey, this is extraordinarily risky. And you have a high degree or high percentage chance you're going to lose all your money. But YOLO, you only live once. And if it works, you're going to become very, very rich. So understand that there's a tremendous amount of risk. And oh, by the way, look at my loss porn over here. I've blown it before in the past. You know, if that came to regular Wall Street, that would actually be a very healthy thing, at least in terms of framing expectations about a lot of stuff. And like I said before, you know, these hedge funds, you know, they can't report, they haven't reported their January numbers yet. And I think a lot of them are afraid to because some of them don't have very good numbers. And let me throw out one other thing that seems to be going on about really sticking it to the man. Activist shareholders. There's a rumbling out there that maybe they should get into activist shareholding. And the name Larry Culp is coming up. He's the chairman of GE. Now, if you're one of these millennial suicide bombers that you're talking about, and I don't think that's an inaccurate description of what some of the momentum types are thinking about right now, it's easy to look at GE, which is now an industrial company, and its history and its problems and the dirty things that they make, and say, okay, I hate them just because of who they are. Then you point out that Larry Culp is standing to make a $47 million payday if the stock can average over $10 a share, and a $230 million payday if it can average over $16 a share. And there's some naysayant arguments out there. Let's prevent that from happening. Let's sell this stock down, short it, whatever we need, to prevent Larry Culp from getting his payday. Now, they're just talking about this. This is kind of over in the corners. But there is some idea that they might try to morph themselves into activist shareholders as well, too. This is a big community. This is a lot of money in aggregate, each individual account being small. And it could go a lot of different directions. And we'll have to see where it goes forward from here. And that's why I'll push back on the idea that it's being engineered by Wall Street hedge funds. I don't think it's being engineered by them, but I do think that they've been reduced to the millennial suicide bombers. As soon as they can figure out what the next trend is, the Wall Street hedge funders will jump in on it too, because they think that the power of this crowd will just make the momentum work for a while.
Jim, I agree emphatically, and I should clarify my earlier comments. I completely endorse the fact that good things are happening on Wall Street Bets. It is wonderful to see retail traders finding the power of the internet and collaboration to help one another stick it to the man, and the man deserves to have it stuck to him. I agree with that. I cheer it. Please don't anybody think that I don't want to see you guys succeed at sticking it to the man. Just be aware of the possibility that the man might be hiding behind a screen name, pretending to be someone who he isn't, and playing you. These guys are as sleazy as they come. In any event, Jim, we're running out of time, so we're going to need to leave it there. But before I let you go, please tell us a little bit more about what you do at Bianco Research.
It's an independent research firm. I'm not affiliated with any brokerage firm or any money manager, have not been for the entire existence of the firm. And we do more macro research, and it has a bit of a fixed income flavor to it because that lends itself better to macro. But as you can see, you know, we don't exclusively stick with fixed income. And it's available as a product, if you will, not a formal newsletter, but a product for people that want to purchase our research. And I also am active on Twitter at Bianco Research. BiancoResearch.com is our website. You could go see what we're about. You know, you could follow me on Twitter as well too, get some ideas of what we're talking about. Now, my Twitter timeline in the last week has been dominated by this Wall Street Bets thing. But if you looked back 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, it was something completely different. And in 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, it might be something completely different again as well too. That's the nature of being a macro researcher. We kind of seek out what is the issue of the day and try and add to that conversation as best we can.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. The Fed has committed to keeping interest rates low for the foreseeable future. That means bond yields, already at record lows, will continue to stay near 0%. So where should you put your hard-earned income? Well, according to a new report from City Private Bank, contemporary art returned 13.6% per year over the last 25 years, compared to only 8.9% for the S&P 500. Contemporary art also has a lower loss ratio than gold, with almost no correlation to the stock market. Masterworks.io is the first and only platform that lets you invest in blue-chip art from artists like Monet and Picasso. Recently, Masterworks.io sold their first Banksy masterpiece for a 32% return net of fees to investors. To learn more, head to Masterworks.io today. See important information at Masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Jim back on the show. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, the biggest thing for me, Patrick, that's forming is this clear pattern, and it's something I've been waiting for years, which is the smartest macro experts that we know. I've been saying for years, look, I don't know when it's coming. I'm not that smart, but someday we're going to get to an inflation problem, and that's where we really get to the end game, where central bankers' hands are tied, and they get to a situation where they can't solve every problem in the world just by printing more money. It seems like all of the smartest guys in the room are coming around to say, okay, looks like it's time. And of course, they each have a different timetable. But look, Jim Bianco has joined the Inflation Club. Russell Napier, who stuck to a very devout deflation story for several years, I think, came around and said, okay, it's time now, it's inflation. So I really think this is the most important thing we need to look at. I guess Lacey Hunt would probably be the last holdout. We ought to get him back on the show at some point for an update and see what he thinks, because I really think that this is going to be the most important macro theme. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to this week's post-game chart book, which is titled Squeeze Insanity Part 2, The Aftermath. I want to start on this GameStop chart. I'm sure you want to have got other stuff that you want to talk about, but I realize here as I look at this, there's an aspect that I forgot to ask Jim Bianco about that I want to touch on, which is part of what happened with GameStop is the reason they knew that it was such a ripe opportunity for a squeeze is because the short interest in GameStop was actually larger than the entire float of GameStop. How is that even possible? Because if the whole idea of short selling is supposedly you borrow shares from somebody who has them and sell them and have to pay them back later, well, wait a minute. How can you borrow more of something than exists for anyone to lend to you? That doesn't seem to make any sense. What's going on here?
Right. So let's talk about this, because that's actually a great question. I'm sure a lot of our listeners will benefit from us trying to explain how this happens. But the one thing that is very evident is that naked short selling has been brought to light as the villain, this idea that there's naked short selling going on that has created or contributed to this short interest being greater than the outstanding float. But it really comes down to the fact that you have to look at it more than beyond one dimension. Short selling has many of the same characteristics as fractional reserve lending. The idea is that the same shares can actually be lent and relent multiple times. So let me explain. So let's say we have a company issue 100 shares and investor A buys those shares and puts them in their margin account in brokerage. And that's the outstanding open float. Now, investor B comes along and wants to short sell the stock and then borrows that inventory of the 100 shares and proceeds to sell it into the market through the exchange. When investor C, a new investor, comes along and buys those 100 shares from the short seller, when they buy them, they're not designated as short stock or borrowed stock. When that investor buys them, they're assuming that they're buying the same shares as investor A has, with all of the same privileges and everything like that. And they deposit in a margin account, and that brokerage that received investor C's shares treats them the same as investor A to lend them out again. And so what happens is you can have a brand new short seller come and borrow investor C shares, even though investor C purchase the shares from short seller B, who borrowed the shares. And so this cycle can repeat itself. And so you can have the short interest actually grow considerably greater than the outstanding float as this cycle can actually perpetuate. So the vast majority of short selling is often passive, though. It's not like everyone's trying to villainize it, and it's done with intentions not to necessarily harm the company. And if there are, of course, cases where that is the case, but actually short selling provides liquidity that greases the wheels of the market. For instance, a lot of times short selling is used by market makers to facilitate hedging or customer purchases or arbitragers that are short selling stock against index futures or ETFs to keep the net asset values in line. Or long short funds are using short selling as a way to hedge or reduce their portfolio volatility. Of course, you'll have the chainoses of the world that are out there to actually try to profit from exposing fraud. But the idea of villainizing broadly short selling, I think, is incorrect. I mean, there are some things that are probably out of balance, and that maybe the SEC has to come in and maybe check whether the rules are right. But overall, I just don't think it's as big of a deal as everyone made it. But that doesn't change the fact that GameStop had this extraordinary squeeze, right, Eric? Like, it was unbelievable, that feedback loop that came in when that kind of golf ball in the garden hose of buy orders came in with margin calls and all sorts of other things that created this extraordinary move. I mean, the stock was like half a year ago, $10 or less a share, and shot up to almost $500. And now that that whole thing has kind of blown off, it's reverted right down to about $68 at the time we're recording. But it's been just a crazy move, but it's very likely over at this stage.
Patrick, something that I've noticed in the last couple of days, and this is after we recorded the interview with Jim Bianco, which was recorded on Tuesday morning this week, it seems to me like it really ought to be clear now that, okay, this short squeeze worked. Some people made some money on it. The squeeze is over. Nobody in their right mind, given that GameStop basically is a mall store, that most of its actual stores are, you know, in malls that are closed down because of the COVID crisis. This is a company whose fundamentals are awful. Nobody in their right mind should be thinking, oh, well, maybe it went to 500 because it's a great company that has great growth potential and it's, you know, going to make a lot of money and it's a good stock to own for the long haul. Nobody anywhere should have ever thought that. This was a squeeze that was perpetrated for the purpose of forcing hedge funds that had concentrated short positions to have to cover, creating a forced buyer that the people who put the squeeze on could sell to, if they were really talented at it, right at the top, over $450. The people who perpetrated the squeeze made a killing. The hedge fund lost half of its value. That's where the story pretty much ends. Now you got a stock trading at $450. Anybody in their right mind ought to expect the next thing that should happen, the only reasonable thing to expect to happen, is that it collapses from $450 back down to what it's really worth. But what I've seen in the last couple of days is like Mark Cuban publicly telling people, if you're in GameStop and you possibly can, you should try to hold it. What? Hold it? Why? It's overvalued by several thousand percent because of a short squeeze that was perpetrated for the purpose of forcing the hand of a hedge fund. That's over and done with. Why is anybody advising anyone? And I really feel for the people who have been suckered into this thing that are being told, okay, keep on holding on to your GameStop shares. Don't panic. It's going to turn around again. Why are they telling them this?
You know what? I guess that's the nature of markets and greed, and the fact that we all come into this market with different perspectives, right? And when you really look at the fact that it was purely a very technical squeeze that happened in terms of just liquidity of shares available and people that needed to cover, I mean, you have to have truly a theme of some sort that there's room to squeeze those shorts again after this extraordinary move. I'm with you. I do feel that there's a very good chance of substantial volatility still. I mean, we could have a swing where the stock still goes up 100% and then wipes it out. But it really, at this stage, I think, is over. The likelihood that we see that stock print up in the 400s again is quite unlikely.
Patrick, let's move on to page 3 in the deck, which is silver. As I mentioned earlier, when we interviewed Jim Bianco, everybody was still talking about, here it goes, we're about to squeeze silver up to $1,000 or some ridiculous thing. It was obvious to me and Jim that that was a really stupid idea back on Tuesday. Looks like the rest of the market has woken up to it. Is that how you see it, or are we going to see more of this squeeze silver to $1,000 silliness coming out of Wall Street Bets?
Well, I think that was really actually, the jury was out for me. Like, I really wanted to see what they could do. Obviously, the FOMO of the thought that silver was going to run away without people in perpetuated a strong gap higher toward 30 and created a really big hype and headline news on that Monday break. But really, since then, it's been giving back. But the part that I found to be the biggest tell is that, to me, I was skeptical that silver was going to be able to, in the bigger picture, decouple from gold. And really, one of the themes that I had was that if silver was legitimately breaking out, it should at least create some tailwind behind gold, and that gold was likely to in some way benefit. Obviously, silver would very likely outperform on a relative basis in terms of the gold-silver ratio and things like this. But I really thought that we wanted to see gold demonstrate that it was benefiting, and that really wasn't the case. And I think when we go to page 4 and see gold, the one thing we noticed almost immediately on that silver gap is that gold couldn't even get above its 50-day moving average. Out of a almost one-month consolidation, it couldn't even make a little bit of a higher high during that entire period. And that was a red flag for me. Like, why would gold not benefit in at least some degree from the fact that silver was making that run? And really, what we can now see, at least in the gold chart, is that some big players used that the spurt of buying to actually sell into. And it really does look like at this stage that some form of another leg lower in gold is underway. Now, like you, I'm actually quite bullish gold in the much bigger picture. But with a breakdown like this below the 200-day moving average, the vulnerability of another $100 to the downside is entirely on the table, maybe heading back at least into the consolidations from April and May of 2020, where we stayed in the mid-1700s in that consolidation. It'll be interesting to see, but, you know, like Paul Tudor Jones always says, with the 200-day moving average is like an incredibly important resource for him. It's like the bull market in gold will really be above that 200 days. So with the fact that we're breaking down here, it's going to, at least on the short term, put pressure on gold and maybe create some really good buying opportunities, maybe even a couple weeks or a month from now.
Patrick, let's talk a little bit more about when you know that this is confirmed, because right now we're only seeing the first candle below that 200-day moving average. What really just jumps off the page to me is, even though on an absolute price basis we're still slightly above that last low from the end of 2020, you know, that might be true, but in terms of how far below the 200-day moving average, and also how decisive the candle that breaks the 200-day moving average is, boy, this really looks to me like it could be the beginning of something, but it is just the first candle. How do you decide? You're the technician here. How do we really decide, okay, the move south is on, and start to make some targets for where it might move from there?
Right. The one thing that I don't like to utilize the 200-day alone as a trading for making my trading decisions, largely because the 200-day moving average is lagging so much behind the price that often much of the market correction can be over by the time the 200-day moving average is even tested. Like, go back to March of 2020 during the COVID crash. I mean, really, even though we violated below the 200-day moving average, it was really when gold got down there that it actually was, in the bigger picture, a cheap and a good buying opportunity. So I don't think that this is, in my mind, a sell signal where one would start to begin short operations on gold. But it does mean that the bull market that we were looking for even a week or two ago to potentially come off of the support of these lines has not yet started. And we are in correction mode, and that may last like that for weeks. And so I think that the best takeaway I would give is that I think be patient for a new opportunity to accumulate a new line of gold. I think that you might be getting better prices here in the coming weeks.
Let's move on to the S&P on page 5. The chart here says that we're at 38.51. Just in the time since the chart's been printed, as you and I are talking, we're already at 38.56. I bet we're going to be at a new all-time high by the time our listeners hear this. What do you make of the S&P? Where are we headed from here?
Well, you know, the interesting thing that we pointed out and we continue to point out is that 50-day moving average acted as a very strong support. And a lot of technicians watch that 50-day moving average just to kind of identify the primary trend. And the fact that we only had a 4 or 5 day market correction that was just over 100 S&P points, that it was bought within 4 or 5 days and returned back to the highs, this is not the big market correction or sell-off that one would be looking for the start of some kind of big mean reverting correction. So at this stage, the path of least resistance remains upwards. I still believe that the market is overextended, very mature. So many characteristics of a bubble top are there. But the thing is that it's always amazing how long bull runs can last and how far they go before they turn. And so really at this stage, I'm going to be watching whether that new high comes in. If it does, it measures out north of 3,900. Toward 4,000, that might be a place where the market will gravitate to in the coming weeks before we see another attempt to begin a correction. So it's definitely on the watch list of things for us to discuss in the coming weeks.
Let's move on to the dollar index on page 6. You can see, looking at the left side of the chart, that, boy, 92 was the level that was support tested 3 or 4 times there during the course of 2020. I'm watching to see whether we can get back up above it. What do you think?
Well, for sure. And there's some technicians that would identify patterns like inverted head and shoulders along the bottom or just basing formations. And often when the dollar being oversold creates a base and then attempts to rally. And the level you're identifying is actually quite relevant. A number of Fibonacci levels lie in that zone as well. That's a support line for the euro as the euro declines toward the 119 level. And so the jury's still out whether this breakout will actually stick as we approach a very critical moment. But, you know, this has been an out of consensus trade. And you know, everyone's talking short squeezing of a GameStop and silver. But I think that the US dollar bear is one of the biggest consensus trades out there. And if there was ever room for a liquidity squeeze the other way to get going, is if this thing got north of that 92 plus level you were just talking about. Will it happen? I mean, that's I'm going to be watching all next week on whether that plays out.
Patrick, let's move on to my own favorite topic, crude oil, on page 7. We're already back up here to above pre-crisis highs. We've yet to revisit the high from the very first days of 2020, but it looks to me like that's coming next. And frankly, I wonder what comes next after that, but I think it's more up. What do you make of this chart?
Well, you know, I wanted to talk about the dollar and crude oil and including the next chart of inflation expectations sort of in one bigger context, because crude oil, I have there the volume by price levels, which is just showing where there was a huge consolidation of oil in this level in the 55 to 60 plus level was where a very large amount of oil transacted. And it's a fair value price, which often acts as an overhead resistance when something price approaches it. And so we have an area where there's room for crude oil to bump its head. I don't want to call it a major turn point or somehow, you know, will mark a major top in oil. But one of the drivers that I view has been driving higher inflation expectations that we're showing on page 8 has been basically weak dollar and rising crude and generally rising commodity prices. And one of the bigger storylines in my mind is, will we see the reflation trade pause? And one of the things that I'll be looking for is that if the dollar was to begin to rally with some momentum and crude oil bumps its head and actually starts to lose some of its upside momentum, well, it will be really interesting to see if inflation expectations start to back off. And I think that this is a really interesting crossover. At minimum, I don't know how much asymmetry there is in continuing to press crude oil higher. It's also interesting that many energy companies have stopped participating, which is the question is, are these energy stocks going to just catch up with a further breakout in crude, or is crude oil just kind of popping a little bit higher and some of the smart money is using that strength in crude to start unloading some of their broader energy exposure? It's a really interesting thing to watch into over the next couple of weeks.
Patrick, let's move on to page 9, high yield corporate bond ETF.
Right. And so what I really wanted to highlight here is that junk bonds often trade with a correlation to equity. And what we've really seen is that high yield junk bonds have really held up, while even the investment grade corporate bonds and obviously treasuries have sold. And this has caused the credit spreads between the junk bond OAS credit spread to narrow to some of the lowest levels we've seen in the last decade. We're trading at 3.68. And really, I find this fascinating because while the Fed has proven that they will provide liquidity to the junk bond market in periods of liquidity crisis, there, I think, is a very important moment coming in the coming year as the coronavirus continues to cause economic havoc. There are going to be a wave of companies that immensely benefit from the changing economy, but also a whole series of companies that get hurt badly by that, particularly brick and mortar companies, and that are going to potentially struggle. And the fact that the junk bonds have not really started to price in default risk at higher levels, I find incredibly confusing. At some stage, I suspect that we're going to see a turn in this, but there's really no sign of it yet. But this is something that I think we have to keep a close eye on, because right now they're acting like there's no risk in seeking the higher returns that come with owning these.
And listeners, you can get a daily update from Patrick with chart books similar to this at bigpicturetrading.com. Information is on page 11. We're going to have to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Patrick, what can they expect to find in this week's Research Roundup?
Today, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Jim Bianco's slide deck and the chart book that we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a Jeffrey Snyder article on what's the complete reflation situation, and a link to an interview with the former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper on commodities, debt, and digital currencies. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.